Good afternoon, everyone. We do not have a quorum, but because we have a very full agenda, I think we will get started. This is the Senate Health Care Committee, and it is March 9th, and welcome, everybody. And I assume we have residents, students, whatever you are. Okay. All right. Welcome. I think we're going to jump to opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 857 first, and Sarah Budnick, come forward. We now have a quorum.
Chair Senator Mons Anderson and other distinguished committee members, I want to thank you for this opportunity to address Senate Bill 857. My name is Sarah Bubinick. I am a Milwaukee, Oregon resident. I am a graduate of Oregon Health and Science University with a medical doctor degree, and I have a master's in public health as well. But most importantly, I have been an Oregon resident for more than 20 years and practiced in the healthcare industry for 17 of those years. I support Senate Bill 857 and urge you to pass this important legislation for the following reasons. First, according to the Oregon Medical Association, 36% of Oregon's population is in rural communities. In areas such as Josephine County, primary care physicians already are seeing 1.5 times the national average of patients, and those numbers are expected to rise. A 2016 study from the CDC notes rural residents are more likely than urban residents to die prematurely from the top 5 causes of mortality in America, such as cancer, respiratory disease, heart disease, stroke, and unintentional injuries. In addition, there is a greater incidence of chronic health conditions such as hypertension and emphysema among rural residents. The healthcare workforce shortages are exacerbated in these areas as well. Communities struggle to attract and keep well-trained providers. The 2012 study has shown that there's going to be a shortage of 45,000 primary care physicians in the next decade. Supplying rural and underserved areas with more providers will improve the overall health outcomes for our most vulnerable populations. Without the support that supervised physicians could add to the capacity of these overburdened primary care providers and practices, the burnout rates will continue to increase and the clinics will see rising costs in recruitment and retention. Secondly, medical school graduates are a lost labor force when they don't do residency. The number of medical school graduates is at an all-time high, not only in Oregon, but in America. The increased output of Oregon medical school graduates and the paucity of primary care residency programs in rural areas gives graduate physicians without licenses few options to work in the healthcare industry and no ability to practice clinical medicine. These medical graduates are an untapped resource. OHSU is the only medical doctor MD school of medicine in the state. As a top-ranked medical school, OHSU has exceptional residency match rate of 98%, but only 23% of these graduates practice in Oregon or find a residency placement in Oregon. The 2% of OHSU graduates that each year do not match in the residency program often leave the profession burdened by significant debt load and unable to practice medicine in any form. Thirdly, medical school graduates meet and exceed the standards for licensure as a PA, a physician's assistant, as a naturopathic doctor, and as a nurse practitioner. After receiving a bachelor's degree, naturopathic physicians and nurse practitioners are able to practice independently in the state of Oregon. Nurse practitioners have 2 to 3 years of clinical training. Physician assistants have 2 years, naturopathic physicians have 4 years, and MDs have 4 years. But MDs are and DOs are the only branch that require a year of residency to practice in Oregon. The out-of-classroom, hands-on patient care portion of medical school training, i.e. 2 years of clinical rotations, is as or more rigorous as the clinical rotations for naturopathic physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners. In addition, medical school students spend more time on clinical rotations and rotate with more services, giving them more exposure to clinical medicine. The fourth issue I want to address is the USMLE. As this bill is written, the Oregon Medical Board shall issue a provisional license to practice medicine to an applicant who passes the United States Medical Licensing Examination, the USMLE. There are three steps to the USMLE. Step one is taken after the first year of medical school, and step two is taken the second year of medical school, but step three is taken after completing 1 year of residency training. Passing the USMLE Step 3 would be the most significant in this legislation because it shows understanding of the foundation of medicine and ensures that the medical graduate has the knowledge to practice under supervision. Looking at the field of practitioners that are currently able to function as primary care providers in Oregon, MDs and DOs without residency that pass the USMLE Step 3 testing meet or exceed these standards. So I'm asking to please consider a Step 3 amendment to this legislation. Today in Oregon, licensure to practice medicine is granted to physicians with 1 year of residency training, as I've said. The USMLE Step 3 is the exam needed to obtain a license in this state after 1 year of training. Medical graduates that can pass this exam will show proficient medical understanding to practice clinically. In conclusion, this bill will allow graduate physicians to practice medicine in the medically underserved areas of the state under board-certified physician supervision. This bill will not dilute the standards of care for patients. It will enhance access to primary care, and it will provide important postgraduate experience for qualified MDs. Bringing graduate physicians to rural areas will strengthen primary care practices through collaboration. Collaborative medical models work well, especially in rural areas that are lacking providers. For example, complex medical issues are best addressed by interprofessional teams. Training future healthcare providers to work in such teams will help facilitate this model, resulting in improved healthcare outcomes for all the patients. I asked for this bill to be sponsored not only to help me live my dream of practicing medicine, but also to support my home state of Oregon to meet the demand for providers to practice in rural areas. As you understand well, rural areas are in desperate need for providers. I interviewed recently at Clatsop County and asked them for a public health position and asked them what their greatest public health need was, and they said unanimously it was lack of providers. We have the opportunity to improve patient care without adding any burden to existing state programs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? I have one question. Have you talked to the Oregon Medical Board about this idea?
I have not yet talked to them about this idea.
Usually it's sort of nice to, I think, get stakeholders involved in something as big of a change as this, and I don't know if the medical board is here, but certainly would like their input at some point while we consider the bill. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
David Walls.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is David Walls. I'm the Executive Director for the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon. OPSO represents over 1,500 osteopathic physicians, residents, and medical students practicing in the state of Oregon. The issues of residencies is something very important to us. We've been an advocate with several other stakeholder groups on increasing residency programs. It's critical part of physician's training and something that we do look forward to working with the state on what we can do to increase residencies. A lot of that is managed by availability of federal funding, but it's something that efforts are on and in place to increase residency programs. OPSO does have a bunch of concerns with this legislation. Rather than if there's issues with students being placed in residency programs, rather than circumventing the residency requirements, what can we do as a state to help students get placed, build Oregon residency programs, as residency training is a key part of comprehensive training of osteopathic physicians and MDs, DOs and MDs. As you may know, DOs do 4 years of medical school. When they graduate from medical school, they move on to their residency training. Right now, there are two different accreditation programs for residency programs. There are AOA accredited programs, which are DO programs, or ACGME accredited programs, MD programs. In 3 years, that's actually going to move to one accreditation system. So a lot of efforts are in place to standardize this process, to make it easier for graduating medical students to apply to these programs and really try and improve the health and make these residency programs more robust. Additionally, concerning in this bill, just the language of it is a little vague. We're not quite sure we completely understand the purpose and intent. As it's written, an osteopathic physician could be a supervising physician under this bill, but a DO graduate, an osteopathic student from a DO school, could not apply for the license. So it only refers to a graduate of an osteopathic medical school. It doesn't make any reference to the comprehensive osteopathic medicine licensing exam, or COMLEX, and that's the board exam that osteopathic students take, although osteopathic students can also take the USMLE as well. But due to that, and again, not sure we completely understand the intent, we would oppose this bill in its current form. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Question? Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
Okay. There's no one else signed up to testify at this point in time. We will see if maybe the proponent of the bill can get some more information from the board, or Oregon Medical Association, Oregon Medical Board. Board, yes. All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing.
Just say OMB.
OMB, yes. Senate Bill 857. And Steiner Hayward, are you ready for Senate Bill 792 and 793?
Yes,
okay, I'm going to open both of these bills, Senate Bill 792 and 793. Oliver, do you want to?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you are Senate Bills 792 and 793, I'll keep my description of the two bills brief because I know we have a lot of testimony and experts. Senate Bill 792 would require drug manufacturers to advertise the wholesale price for drug paid by pharmacies in Oregon, and would create a civil penalty if drug manufacturers fail to disclose the wholesale price in its advertising. Senate Bill 793 would provide the Department of Consumer and Business Services the authority to oversee, regulate the cost of prescription drugs in Oregon. There's a dash one amendment on all this for Senate Bill 792. There is no fiscal or revenue impacts on either bill.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senate District 17. Every 4 weeks, when I get an IV infusion of the drug that controls my multiple sclerosis and know that the cost of the drug has increased from about $4,000 per dose to $16,000 per dose over the 10 years I've been on the drug, I feel guilty. I feel guilty that I'm using the resources that such a price enables. And I feel grateful that I have health insurance and a job that provides me with great health insurance, that allows me to afford this drug, that lets me stay a productive citizen, that allows me to contribute to my community and my state in the ways that I'm able to do. This drug has been on the market for over 15 years. It has not been approved for any new indications. It is only approved for multiple sclerosis, and that work was done prior to FDA approval almost 15 years ago. And yet the price has quadrupled over the past 10 years. I have such good health insurance, but that's not true for many Oregonians for whom this drug and so many others are unaffordable for reasons that are completely unclear to me and anyone else trying to understand drug pricing. These working class and middle class Oregonians want to be productive members of our state, want to contribute in the same ways that you and I are able to do so, yet they lack the jobs with good health insurance, or they're on exchange plans with very high deductibles and hefty cost-sharing mechanisms once their insurance benefit actually kicks in, and are unable to afford their drugs. This problem was recently illustrated by a story about Gloria Rogers in the recent Portland Business Journal article. And if I think my drug's price has gone up dramatically, wait till you hear about Gloria's. When Gloria was 4 and a half, she was diagnosed with a rare genetic mutation that caused seizures. She was hospitalized for 2 weeks, but her condition continued to deteriorate, and she lost the ability to eat by mouth. When she was airlifted up to Portland, the specialists up there were able to diagnose her with infantile spasms and prescribed a drug called Acthar, a frontline treatment for the syndrome. However, the drug cost $35,000 a vial. Now, at first, her parents thought this medication was some sort of experimental treatment or had just been invented. In fact, this drug has been around since the 1950s and was off patent. But in 2001, Questcor Pharmaceuticals bought the rights to Acthar, which at that time cost $40 a vial, and raised the price 85,000%. This is not an easy problem to solve, and I will not claim that. The way drugs are developed and the ways they're paid for makes solving this problem hard. But I think there are a couple things we can do, and I'm going to start with a couple of quick slides to illustrate. This slide here shows a trend line over the decades of the cost of drugs. There are specialty drugs in the light blue, traditional drugs in the medium blue, and the overall drug trend in the dark blue. And you can see that just in the past couple of years, just since 2013, the prices have gone up dramatically higher than any kind of inflation you could see anywhere in this country, or really anything other than a country undergoing ridiculous price inflation. This slide shows that it's not just a specialty drug issue. There's high drug pricing across the market. Doxycycline, a drug that many kids take for acne or we use for certain core infections, was $20 a bottle in 2013. In 2014, it was $1,800, almost $1,850 a bottle. That's a drug I took when I was 13 years old, and I'm 54 now. So it's not exactly a new drug. Acthar, we've already talked about. Insulin that's been on the market one way or another since the 1920s, has gone from $220 a bottle to $1,200, a drug that people literally cannot live without. The EpiPen, we've all heard about that. A life-saving device for people with anaphylactic reactions. My daughter needs one of these. $56? $300. Actually, now it's $300 per pen. Not even that number that's there. All of these drugs are drugs that people across Oregon use every single day. And those are brand names up there, but almost all of them are available as generics. And it's the generics that are going up as high. Sorry, wrong direction. There we go. And this shows you the average price per of name brand versus general inflation. You can see that the general inflation in 2013 was 1.5%, but drug prices went up 12.9%. This one shows the role of specialty drugs. Now, specialty drugs are these newer targeted drugs that are really important in healthcare, and I'm not going to say they're not. They're life-saving in some cases. They allow people to live long, productive lives without some of the adverse effects we see from other treatments. So I'm not saying we don't need these drugs. But when they've been on the market as long as mine is, and mine's one of those drugs, it's unclear to me why the price needs to go up by a multiple of four, from 4,000 to 16,000 a dose. Again, you'll see here that specialty drugs are the fastest growing component of healthcare costs. And it's going to show up. Most of you will have heard, in fact, we've had discussions in this committee about the new drugs that treat hepatitis C. The earliest example of this was the drug Sovaldi that came out initially at $80,000 for a course of treatment. Now, it's a life-saving treatment, potentially, and it can literally cure the disease without many of the adverse effects. And that's a great thing. But the company that now owns the patent to Sovaldi made back their entire investment, which they got just by buying a company that had actually developed a drug, in the first 3 months the drug was on the market. The price has come down, but nowhere close to what you think it might, maybe should have. And you can see from this that the cancer drugs are similar. and they're doing the same thing, and this is the new normal when it comes to drug prices. The last slide I want to show you is this. Pharmaceutical manufacturers will tell you that prices are so high because of research and development. Now, as I mentioned to you, if they're developing it for new indications and they're doing the research that's necessary and the testing that's necessary to get an FDA-approved indication for a new drug, I could understand prices staying up a little bit. But when there's a drug like Tysabri, where there has been no new indication in the 15 years it's been on the market, then it becomes a little less unclear. But this graphic shows you an important difference. In orange, you'll see the amount that drug companies spend on sales and marketing. And in blue, you'll see the amount they spend on research and development. And in almost every case, the amount that they spend on sales and marketing is almost double the amount that they spend on research and development. So if the costs of drugs are really related to the cost of research and development, it becomes even more unclear why they're so high. Senate Bills 792 and 793 aim to address these dramatic increases by two approaches. First, we want consumers to be aware of what the drugs they see in direct-to-consumer advertising could cost. Second, just as insurance companies must undergo rate review through the Department of Consumer and Business Services, ensuring that premiums are justifiable based on costs incurred by the insurance companies, we believe pharmaceutical manufacturers should be subject to similar rate review for drug pricing. The United States is one of only two countries in the world that allows direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs, and the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that such advertising is protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Unfortunately, while these ads paint a rosy picture of what life would be like if people used these drugs and encourage people to think they have conditions that they may not really have or can be treated with less dramatic ways, they do not provide information on the cost-benefit analysis for these drugs, leading consumers to believe that their physicians are simply withholding important therapy without justification. While the ability to market in this way is protected, we know from other ads we see every day that the government may also require that additional information be included in ads. For example, most people know what the term MSRP, or manufacturer suggested retail price, means, since we hear it or read it in ads for new cars every single day, because the government requires that it's in there. We also know who's paying for political ads, because every time we see one or hear one, we can tell who paid for it, because that's required. When it's in the state's best interest, state or federal, it's allowed to require information to be included in advertising so that there's some truth in the advertising. Senate Bill 792 requires that all direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription pharmaceuticals include the list or wholesale price of the drug. We're still working on exactly how to define that. That's the Dash 1 amendment that you'll see. The price that manufacturers use as a starting point when they sell their drugs. This simple addition to these ads will give consumers more information about medications they're being encouraged to ask for. It will also allow consumers to find out directly when manufacturers increase prices. Senate Bill 793 calls for transparency about what drives the cost of pharmaceutical pricing with regard to research and development, marketing, how much profit is needed, coupons and patient assistance they offer, so that we can gain some insight into why drugs are priced the way they are. It establishes a drug pricing unit in the Department of Consumer and Business Services, analogous to the rate-setting function performed by the insurance commissioner and her team. You will hear more from Mr. Allen, the director of DCBS, but put simply, this new law would require pharmaceutical manufacturers to go through a rate-setting process through DCBS, providing DCBS with information about research and development, marketing, and marketing costs, manufacturing and marketing costs to justify the cost of their drugs. It holds price increases to 3.4% per year, which is the rate of medical inflation in the state of Oregon. We think this is a reasonable number. To allow manufacturers of brand new drugs to recoup costs, it would only apply to drugs that have been on the market more than 3 years, which is the industry standard expectation for recouping research and development costs. You'll hear a range of testimony against these bills. Drug manufacturers will say we're violating their First Amendment rights. I have had preliminary conversations with the Department of Justice about this issue, and they believe it is unlikely that that's true, given the precedents I mentioned above. Healthcare providers in Oregon have been trying to keep healthcare costs reasonable. They're working hard to be partners in controlling costs that keep employers from hiring more people, that keep the state spending too much money on Medicaid, that keep everyday Oregonians from affording drugs that could dramatically improve their quality of life and productivity. We think that they deserve the government being on their side. And so we urge you to consider seriously Senate Bill 792 and 793. Thank you so much. Happy to take any questions.
Questions for Senator Steiner Haywood? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pat Allen, Mark Florian, and Sean Parkman.
Thanks again.
Please proceed, Pat.
Thank you, Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I've been asked to just make a couple of comments about the bill. First, obviously, the department's neutral on the bill itself, as we are with most legislation. Certainly, if the legislature and the governor decide to assign us this work, this is work that we can do. It's certainly consistent with our consumer protection mission, and it's different in kind but not in nature from the work that we already do, as Senator Steiner Hayward said, around health insurance rate review. In fact, in some respects, it might even be a little bit more straightforward when we're looking at health insurance rates. We're essentially assessing a moving animal while it's in movement, and so we're looking at actuarial issues. We're looking at the underlying finances of the company itself and how what human behavior over the period of a 12-month policy year will be and what are appropriate rates. In the case of drug prices, as I understand the requirements of the bill right now, we're really looking at identifying costs that have gone into the development of a drug and assessing the need for increases potentially above the stated inflation rate that's in the bill. So we've got some notion of how we would go about doing that. We would need a fairly significant different kind of capacity than we have right now. This is not the kind of work that we would be able to take to our existing team of health insurance rate review staff and actuaries and simply pitch it to them. We would need new expertise that we don't currently have, and so I'd want to be clear about that. The last point I would make is there's been some question about how drug prices or changes in drug prices or anything around this kind of a bill would impact the rate review process. And what I would say is when we set health insurance rates in the individual and small group markets, which are the part that we regulate, we look at the underlying actual costs of the insurance companies, and we look at their projections of what their costs will be going forward. And so their projections are going to be based on, as I said before, different moving parts: the health of the population that they're insuring, the diagnoses that they have, and obviously, among other things, the drugs that those people are prescribed. They make projections. We assess those projections, and we establish a rate. But we also have a backward look element in the subsequent rate review that looks at how those projections played out in terms of the profitability of the company or not, its contributions or not to its capital, the adequacy of its capital levels, and those kinds of things. And so over time, if the company and or we basically kind of miss on some of those projections, high or low, we're able to incorporate those changes into subsequent rate review. And so that's a system that is essentially self-correcting over time. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Sean Parkman. I am a member of SEIU 503, and I am the vice chair of the Public Employees Benefit Board. I'm testifying today on behalf of SEIU 503, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 792 and Senate Bill 793. Rising pharmaceutical prices are undermining PEB's goal to keep costs low. From 2014 to 15, costs experienced by PEB for specialty medications increased 28.4%. Our costs for brand prescriptions rose 16%, even while the number of brand drugs prescribed went down more than 5%. This is not sustainable, and it is not a sign of a healthy marketplace. If left unchecked, pharmaceutical prices will force PEB to push a higher cost burden onto members, decreasing their access to life-saving drugs and further eroding one of the pillars of Oregon's middle class. Meanwhile, the profits of pharmaceutical companies have reached truly irresponsible levels. Pharmaceutical prices are largely beyond the influence of the PEB board. This problem is calling out for state legislative intervention. Senate Bill 792 and Senate Bill 793 contain some of the most effective corrective actions of any state laws yet to be considered. Senate Bill 792 provides some much-needed transparency to the market to help consumers make informed decisions. Senate Bill 793 provides immediate relief on soaring pharmaceutical costs by establishing a cap of 3.4% on price increases, the same number that is currently imposed on all coordinated care organizations, PEB, and OAB, and is an established Oregon expectation for reasonable medical cost increases. Yet, Senate Bill 793 creates some flexibility to the Department of Consumer and Business Services and rule writing authority to take into account cases where particular drugs do have legitimate justification for costs above 3.4%. These two pieces of legislation are balanced answers to an imbalanced marketplace. I urge the committee to consider this issue as urgent and in need of legislation, specifically Senate Bill 793 and Senate Bill 792 this year. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Chair Monis-Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Florian. I'm the Vice President of Actuarial and Underwriting for Pacific Source, and I'm a Fellow of the Society of Actuaries and a member of the American Academy of Actuaries. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 793. Pacific Source is an independent, not-for-profit regional health plan based in Oregon, serving nearly 215,000 Oregonians. We serve commercial, Medicaid, and Medicare lives and are the contracted coordinated care organization in Central Oregon and the Columbia River Gorge. Pacific Source has been actively engaged in efforts to address the growing impact of prescription drug costs, and I wanted to take a few minutes to share some of what we're seeing in the way of drug price trends among specialty drugs as well as generic drugs that have been on the market for many years, and to try to connect the dots a bit between these drug prices and the impact on health insurance premiums. I'd also like to briefly highlight, kind of reinforce Director Allen's comments around the rigorous nature of Oregon's health rate review process. It's one of the most robust in the country. It requires both significant transparency and accountability from Oregon's health insurers in order to protect consumers while also ensuring that rates are both reasonable and adequate. So to begin with some trend and cost impact data, looking at our Oregon commercial group and individual membership, our total drug expense measured on a per member per month basis has increased from $52.64 in 2012 to $77.61 in 2016, which is an annual rate of increase of 10.2%. Again, that includes generic, brand, and specialty drugs combined. Drilling down a bit, from 2012 to 2016, our cost, again, per member per month, specifically for specialty drugs, increased from $12.40 to $29.75, an increase of 140% over a four-year period, or an annualized rate increase of 25%. These specialty drugs in 2016 represent about 1% of total prescriptions dispensed to this population, but represent 38% of the expense. These high-cost drugs, as we saw in the slides earlier, continue to become a bigger and bigger piece of our overall spend, and with continued and projected double-digit cost increases, they've become one of the primary drivers of premium increases. Pacific Source and other carriers take efforts to encourage utilization of the most cost-effective services possible, and that extends into pharmacy in terms of generic equivalents. In 2016, about 88% of the prescriptions dispensed to our Oregon commercial members were for generic drugs, which is higher than industry averages. This increased use of generic equivalents has helped to hold down our prescription drug trend over the years. Unfortunately, there are generally not generic equivalents available for specialty drugs, and the pipeline of new generic medications has dried up considerably. Compounding this fact, recently we've started to see prices increase significantly on generic medications as well, even some of that have been produced for several years. From 2012 to 2016, our cost per generic prescription increased at an annual rate of 5.2%. Again, our projections of pharmacy claims, as Director Allen alluded to, go directly into consumer premiums in our rate filings for review by the Department of Financial Regulation. Pharmacy claims, in recent years, pharmacy claims and projected future pharmaceutical cost increases have become a significant driver of premiums. I wanted to address one of the concerns raised by opponents of this bill is around the potential that this type of cap on prescription drug price increases could create a windfall for insurers. Just wanted to discuss briefly that really there are three layers of consumer protection that would prevent that from happening. First and probably most obviously is that the Oregon health insurance market is very competitive, includes several insurers. If one carrier was not to recognize the impact of this legislation in their prices, they would lose business to the carriers who do. Secondly, as Director Allen alluded to, the rate review process in Oregon is extremely rigorous. It includes a 30-day public comment period. It includes in-depth review by department actuaries with questions and answers, multiple rounds of question and answer between department actuaries and carrier actuaries. And also includes a public rate hearing where additional questions are asked and the public has the ability to testify, including the consumer advocacy group Osberg. The third layer of protection is that we are held to federal minimum loss ratio requirements. If a carrier were to experience excess gains, those are required to be rebated to policyholders. So those three layers of protection will ensure that savings resulting from this or other legislation will be passed on to Oregonians. In closing, we feel these cost trends are unsustainable, and we think it's time for all parts of the healthcare system to work collaboratively towards a comprehensive solution built on transparency, accountability, and affordability for consumers. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 793, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Florian, thank you for addressing that issue in particular, because I know that there's some concern about that. Mr. Parkman, you know, as co-chair of the Human Services Subcommittee, I look at PEB costs a lot, PEB and OM costs a lot, and I'm well aware of the role that drug prices have played in the increasing cost of PEB to the state. Could you talk a little bit how, in a self-insured plan like PEB, controlling these prices would affect the average worker and would affect the state's ability to control its overall costs?
Yes. Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, thank you for that question. So being self-insured and also publicly funded, PEB stands not, we wouldn't stand to gain anything from saving money other than to be able to meet our goals of holding costs low for the state. But there's no benefit to the individuals on the PEB board. We don't get a bonus or something like that for having saved money. So there's no pockets being lined there. It's publicly funded. So what would happen is, if costs were held lower because of these kinds of cost containment legislation, especially in pharmaceuticals, we'll be in a position to have a healthier reserve fund. And if we can have a healthier reserve fund for long enough, that could mean that the state legislature we might be able to have some of that money come back to the legislature, or less allocated to PEB in order to cover costs. That would be the end effect. The other effect would be that, as I mentioned in the testimony, if we're facing a situation where price crunches are coming to PEB and we're still contained to this 3.4% growth, but pharmaceuticals are growing way beyond that, then eventually we'll get to a point where our reserves are starting to be eaten into by rising costs that are not sustainable. And that will force a situation where we have to make some very ugly choices between cutting benefits to workers or, you know, forbid it, you know, coming to the legislature for more money or something like that. So that that those are the consequences of, you know, sort of the current pathway. But legislation like this can preserve those benefits, and also the state budget ultimately is preserved.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. Thank you.
No further questions. All right. Thank you very much, Rocky Dellum and Sharon Brigner. Yeah, I was going to try and separate pros and cons, but you can.
My testimony is kind of linked to hers.
Okay, so Rocky, can you let these two go, and then you be in the next panel?
We're all together, so. Yeah.
Well, actually, there's a couple of others that are with you, too. Okay.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I'm Linda Gardner, representing Pharma, and with me is Sharon Brigner, who is Deputy Vice President of Pharma. Sharon will present Pharma's testimony on Senate Bill 792 and 73, but I'd like to reserve a minute afterward to discuss, at the end of her testimony, the free speech provision of the Oregon Constitution, because she's going to tell you about the United States Constitution's free speech provisions.
Thank you. Thank you, Linda. Chairman Mones Anderson and distinguished members of the committee, I appreciate your time and listening to me. I'm Sharon Brigner with Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, an organization that represents over 30 different member companies based in Washington, D.C., devoted to making new cures and treatments for patients throughout the country. I'm a registered nurse by training, and I firmly believe in what I do, and I'm here today to talk to you about my opposition and our organization's opposition to Senate Bill 792. First, this bill violates constitutional law, the First Amendment free speech. Manufacturers are already regulated under a special division of FDA called the Office of Prescription Drug Promotion, or OPDP. And that already tells our manufacturers what they can say within their ads. And secondly, and most importantly, this bill does nothing to help patients. Patients care about affording and accessing their medicines and the treatments that they need. And if the intent of this bill is to try to give a price comparison to understand how to find a medicine that's cheaper, I can understand that. And there are tools that already exist, price finder tools such as rxpricequotes.com. On my first point, where the bill is a First Amendment issue, there is current case law in the books from 2011 that talks about where the Supreme Court struck down some of the same issues that would be found in this particular legislation. It's unconstitutional because it mandates speech on a targeted group. And second point of not doing anything for patients. Patients are concerned, as I said, about finding a price of a medicine. I have an identical twin sister in Texas. We both take a drug called Protonix. This morning I looked at it if it's for a reflux. You can see right here in Salem using the zip code on the RX price finder, pricequotes.com, that on Costco on one block it costs $18.73. Walgreens at $7.05. So all that to say, there are price-finding tools if that is the intent of this bill, which I do believe there's good intent in helping patients try to find their medicines. But this is not the bill, and this is not the vehicle. So I respectfully encourage those here and our other legislators in Oregon to oppose Oregon's Senate Bill 792.
Okay. Well, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Sharon has described to you a little bit about the federal constitution and the First Amendment challenges that this presents, but there's much more depth of it in her written testimony. But I want to tell you about the Oregon Constitution, which even has a much stronger protection of free speech in Article 1, Section 8. That provision provides that no law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever. And the Oregon Supreme Court has held that that protection does not make any distinction between commercial speech and non-commercial speech. And so it gives the strongest protection whatsoever to commercial speech and makes no distinction as is possible under the federal constitution.
And if I may add just another minute on the DTC, a lot of folks ask us, how much Sharon or Pharma does Pharma spend on research and development versus DTC? Overall, we spend over $58 billion in research and development to bring a drug to market. It takes 10 to 12 years to bring a drug from bench to bedside, and there are 12 successes. That's 88 failures. I'm a neurology nurse by training, worked at NIH on MS protocols and Alzheimer's protocols, and just taking Alzheimer's, there was 123 attempts since 2015 and only 4 success rates. We're in an expensive, risky area of research, and now is not the time to impose legislation that could restrict active innovation for patients that really need us.
Just a comment. First of all, when I did a lot of campaigning this summer, did a lot of door knocking, and I ran into several, mainly seniors, who were actually cutting back on their drugs, and they complained about insulin. They complained about actually a number of different drugs, and then when I said, well, if you would contact your doctor, maybe he can help you get a cheaper drug. And I know you mentioned Price Finder, but you know, what needs to happen is you need to be educating the doctors to make sure that every patient knows that they can use that, because the prices are getting out of control. And we are paying for research and design here, but the other countries aren't. And so they do have drug controls, and we do not. It's an equity issue and a fairness issue, and I am very, very concerned that what is happening to some of our seniors and those without adequate economic means to afford their drugs. I would love to see you be at the table offering innovative solutions to the price of drugs. We have a number of solutions on the House side. We have a number of solutions here on the Senate side. So although I take your testimony very seriously, I still would love to see some more active participation in working the bills that we have, or coming up with new innovative ways.
Yes, Chairwoman. And also, I didn't finish my entire thought. I forgot to mention, of the $58 billion that we spend on R&D, $5 billion is spent on DTC. And as a nurse and one that worked in the ERs on weekends just up until a year ago, I loved seeing patients come in. And maybe they weren't all factually correct in why they needed a particular drug, but it elicited an important conversation between the healthcare provider and the patient. And interestingly enough, a GAO report that was recently released showed that only 2 to 7% of patients who walked into the ER or to the doctor's office left with a prescription they requested, but more importantly, 50% of them had a dialogue where the provider said, hey, you need a lifestyle change or a behavioral change or something different from the drug they were requesting. But again, it elicited that important conversation. DTC can also improve adherence, reminding patients to take their medications. But to your final point, and very important point, offering solutions, we do support legislation and solutions that would offer transparency to patients on how to find their drugs, what's the formulary design looking like, what's the cost to them out of pocket, what will they pay at the pharmacy when they pick up their medicines, and what's ultimately going to improve access to those medicines to drive down healthcare costs and improve outcomes.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little confused. And I'm not trying to set you up. I'm not trying to be difficult. The slide that I showed a significant disparity between marketing costs, not necessarily specifically DTC, but marketing costs in general. And I know that's bigger than just DTC, and R&D. And yet the numbers you cite a 10-to-1 difference between in favor of 11-to-1. In fact, research and development to DTC advertising. Can you clarify that for me, please?
I'm so glad you brought up that slide. In fact, it's on our little screen, but not on the bigger screen. But I do respectfully take exception to your slide, and I am curious as to the source of this slide, because we have documentation that shows when you look exclusively at DTC, not administrative costs and not business costs, that it is a fraction of what the costs of the particular R&D and the investments going in to bring a drug from bench to bedside is. So I don't know what that sources.
But the Washington Post article on the cost of pharmaceuticals within the past few months.
Okay. I would love to follow up with you just on our data to show you the...
Sure.
Because our companies disclose a lot.
We may be comparing different numbers.
Apples to oranges, yes.
Yeah.
I think that might be the case here, but I'd be happy to provide that information this week. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? Rocky.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. Rocky Dahlem here on behalf of the Oregon Bioscience Association, or Oregon Bio. Oregon Bio supports the regional bioscience community through networking, workforce development, educational programs, enterprise support, advocacy, and the promotion of research collaborations. And I'm here today to talk in general about both of these bills and another issue that I think you just raised, Chair Monis Anderson, about what the effects are here on Oregon, and particularly our bioscience and biotech sector, which is growing due to some great investments, both private and public here in the state, where we don't have any headquartered major manufacturers and are tapping into this industry. I'd first say we appreciate Senator Steiner Hayward's work and our conversations over the past few months. These bills are no surprise to us because we've had a number of discussions about these concerns, and we look forward to continuing those discussions. And as you mentioned, we have been on both sides of the building with many members, and we anticipate that that will continue throughout throughout session. Just a little bit about our industry here in Oregon, and this is from an economic study that was released earlier in 2016, but the bioscience industry here in Oregon is estimated about $10.3 billion, 46,000 jobs, and linked to around $340 million in tax and fee revenues for the state and local governments. Biotech is particularly diverse. First of all, 49% of bioscience companies reside outside of the metro area. 47% of Oregon's biotech workforce is female, and 22% is represented by minorities. So this sector is growing and also represents a really broad number of jobs and well-paying jobs. Our concerns specifically when we talk about mechanisms on price control or price caps or what those effects are on research and innovation here in Oregon. I'd say generally, and we've had difficult discussions about this, but in general, what Oregon Bio has been sharing is that Oregon is a difficult place to access capital to start with. We hate to say it, but we are a flyover state between two hubs of biotech, which is Seattle and San Francisco. As we've had major investment, private and public, in the state, we're attracting more money here, whether it's private VC money or whether or not it's partnership with big companies. And as we look at issues like this, and Oregon's on the leading edge, and certainly respect the discussions about costs, both for our public employees and private plan members, then we have to look at what it means for our industry here, and as a whole, what it means for research and innovation. And I put this bluntly, but I put it very seriously. There is a question about how you control the cost of the current medications we have and what we desire as new medications that come to market and new therapies. I've got an example here. Bio International Organization also submitted testimony that you have, but one example is HIV drugs. After the introduction of antiretroviral therapies, hospital spending on HIV patients decreased by 43%. We've talked about the hepatitis C drugs. I think there's two interesting points. It's unfortunate. I was a member of the drug pricing work group in the interim, and it always seems to be a footnote that Hep C also provided a cure, and I appreciate you, Senator, for raising that. We had discussions about that pricing during interim days back as far as 2014, and the cost of that drug has come down significantly. As what Sharon pointed out, too, part of the difficulty that our industry is having is educating both the public and members about R&D. I think you used a number by the hundreds, but typically 9 out of 10 clinical trials fail. Yeah. What I'll tell you about our industry here in Oregon is those clinical trials that are happening are all with small companies and new drugs. And to get a drug to market, those clinical trials don't just take having a drug or an idea that you bring out of an institution, but first finding someone to manufacture that prototype. I think it was illuminating for many to understand that when you take a drug into clinical trial, you now pay the healthcare costs of all of the participants of that clinical trial. So the costs are very real, and the education with the public these days is very difficult to understand as they fortunately write checks to patient advocacy groups and others to find cures. They also have a disconnect between what it really costs to bring these cures and what they're doing for our healthcare costs. We also would point out that, unfortunately, when we see the data and we look at actuaries actuary data, the plans can't incorporate the costs of savings. I take the Hep C drugs as an instance that we can't capture because actuarials won't look forward, and that's for risk reasons and makes good sense for their purposes, can't anticipate the cost and savings on liver transplants, dialysis, kidney transplants, and hospital stays. I use the example of an oral chemo drug as well. An oral chemo drug drives down the may be the same cost as a chemotherapy that's issued either in a doctor's office or a hospital, but reduces trips to the hospital, stays, and all sorts of other costs that go along with it. So as we close, without specifically addressing the bills, we think that there are some problems with these bills that don't necessarily take into account the full R&D costs, not just the direct cost to a specific drug that's on the market. But we'd also say it's a difficult look for Oregon as we look at capping prices, and we'd ask that you would consider that very carefully, what it means to access innovation and the growth of Oregon's sector. So happy to answer any questions in that realm, but we appreciate the discussion and look forward to continuing it over the coming months.
Would you be willing to work with Senator Steiner Hayward and Senator Cruz on possible changes to make these bills better or new suggestions? Because I am going to be having a work group.
Senator, or Chair Monica Anderson and members of the committee, yes, Oregon Bio would invite an invitation to be part of that and welcome an invitation to be part of those discussions. As a member of the House work group, but I would also note, which Sharon alluded to, there were several other bills that came out of the work group that that we are tracking that aren't our bills. SB 237 and 272 are both bills that get to addressing formulary changes as well as some of the issues around the chain of command and the supply chain for drugs. I think one of the challenges when we talk about DTC is capturing not just the list price, but the rebates and what happens in the rebate process with how drugs are priced. And there's a lot of questions and a lot of learning for all of us on what the cost is for a drug. So thank you.
Yes, and Chairwoman, I have not yet addressed my issues with SB 793. Could I go into that?
Mm-hmm.
I liked how you did it together, but I just forgot to talk about 793. Thank you, Rocky. I'm also here to testify in opposition to 793, and the first and foremost objection that we have to this price cap bill is that it does nothing to help patients afford their medicines. In fact, I do contend that it is a giveaway to the healthcare insurers because manufacturers are forced to justify and refund excessive price increases. Today, it's actually common for a patient to pay full list price of a medicine when they're within paying the deductible, even though the insurer receives a rebate from the manufacturer. By focusing solely on manufacturers in this legislation, it really does nothing to address the true costs and problems that patients have to access their medicines. This bill also does not take into account the medical offsets that Rocky alluded to, the fewer ER admissions and hospitalizations that are incurred because of medicines, with patients taking medicines exactly as prescribed. There's an estimate of $213 billion that could be saved a year if patients would take medications as their physicians and nurse practitioners have instructed. The bill also fails to take into account the utilization management techniques that insurers employ, many of them limiting patient access to therapies by restrictive formularies and adverse benefit designs, and that has to change. What a patient pays at a pharmacy, secondly, is not what is solely determined by a drug's list price. It is determined by an entire variety of stakeholders, and Rocky alluded to this when he talked about the supply chain. The drug supply chain is extremely complex and involves several different stakeholders, and the chain entities are the supply chain entities are actually the beneficiaries of significant manufacturer rebates and discounts that are provided, not the manufacturers. In fact, there is a recent BRG report that we're happy to share if it has not yet been shared, Berkeley Research Group, that sheds light on the role played by other supply chain stakeholders. It showed that brand manufacturers only receive 39% of drug spend, while PBMs, health plans, providers, and others benefited from the rest of that healthcare spend on drugs. The bill is thirdly, the bill is unclear as to what price manufacturers would need to report. AMP, average manufacturer price, which is what the bill defines as triggering the price increase, is not what manufacturers use. We'd start negotiating upon wholesale acquisition price or list price. In 2015 alone, our manufacturers paid $284 million in rebates, and $103 million went to the state of Oregon. That's what the mandatory rebates are that we've already paid, and that's so this it was this legislation would add to already a heavily regulated industry. And importantly, as the director from the department had said earlier in our hearing, the requirement would be so incredibly burdensome on the department. We ran numbers on prices that increased of drugs. That would, if you had an increase of 10%, and this bill has 3.4%, of 10% increase would yield 2,300 products that you would get rolling over the over across the year. So if you brought that down to 3.4, it would be several more thousand drugs captured in that. And I just asked, does the department have the actuarial expertise and resources on hand to work with this data and interpret it meaningfully? But again, what? How is this data going to help a patient? How are they going to afford their medications in an easy way where they can take it? And it's, how is this not going to hamper innovation? Because as I had mentioned, this is an expensive, risky proposition to bring a drug to market. We're proud of the innovations we're making, and we respectfully oppose SB 793 as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
A couple of really quick things.
And then while you ask, let's get the last person that's opposed to it. Jack?
Well, Madam Chair, before we go there, let's...
Okay. Well, okay. You're next.
I will pass.
Okay.
I will cover mine under 419.
Okay. All right.
Thank you. You know, I appreciate the concerns that you raised about the speech issues. And I hear what you're saying about them protecting you being able to say whatever you want. And I don't disagree that those protections are afforded by both the U.S. and the state constitution. But precedent suggests that you are that it is permissible under the Constitution to require you to include additional information in those advertisings. That has never been forbidden by the Supreme Court, either the U.S. or the Oregon Supreme Court. The ability to advertise has been protected, and I acknowledge that, and I know you acknowledge it, and I agree with it. But the requirement of adding additional information has never been seen as being a violation of the First Amendment or Article 1, Section 8.
Chairwoman Sanderson, Senator Steiner-Hayward, I think that if you take a look at the Oregon cases, you'll find that mandated speech is the same as restrictions on speech. And I would say as a practical consideration, there are other factors involved, such as, you know, different formulations of drugs, different dosages of drugs would require, I can't even imagine how much you would have to, there are 40 different formulations or dosages, you would have to declare all of them, and I don't see how that could possibly help a consumer.
Well, that's a separate issue. But, and Madam Chair, if I may, just to clarify one other thing. This is parts for Mr. Dallin. We actually passed legislation. You said that research protocols are required to pay for all the patient's care, but we passed legislation in this state a few years ago that requires commercial insurers to pay for standard of care. And the Oregon Health Authority is also required to pay standard of care through OHP. So any cost that would be normally incurred by a patient for caring for that disease are covered by insurance, not by the research protocol. Did I misunderstand what you said?
Chair Monsey Anderson, Senator Steiner-Hayward, that may be true. The point I think we would make is the incredible costs that go in, including some of the coverage and the risks, because you have to cover, an insurer won't and isn't required to cover potential side effects that they don't know come from the drug. So that may be true, and I don't mean to argue with you to make the point that I think there's a major lack of understanding with the public and certainly policymakers nationwide about what it really takes to bring a drug to market. And that is not to say that explains all of the price and questions we have about drug pricing that we've seen over the last year or so, but it's a major component that's misunderstood. And I just, if I may, I think another component that's majorly misunderstood is what comes out of our public research institutions and what happens with commercialization, and that research and development is by and large not done by the public, and those are foundational pieces of information that's intellectual property that comes out. So the cost to get those to market, including the health costs for clinical trials, is high, but you may be correct, so I don't mean to mislead the committee.
I would like to see
your organizations give some community benefit by maybe advertising Price Finder and ways, making it a big deal to let the consumer know how they can find a less expensive drug.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I will commit to you that we will look at ways to educate consumers and patients on adherence and finding medications, such as the Price Finder tools we have identified today. Thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah. A little slightly off topic, but not necessarily. sometimes I'm on top of it. So. Last week, the president made a little speech before Congress, and he actually specifically mentioned drugs and pharmaceutical pricing. But he kind of took it from a different angle. His focus was on FDA and streamlining process to get to market. Wouldn't that have a significant impact on pricing?
We believe in pharma, and our member companies are absolutely supportive of expediting FDA review of medications and getting the generics more quickly to market as well. That is something we're very supportive of.
Okay, I mean there are other factors in here and incredibly lengthy process you have to go through even to get to market is definitely a cost driver in the price of drugs. So,
Senator Beyer.
Definitely, Chair. You would know better than I, but didn't the Obama administration actually do a lot towards that in their first 4 years? They reduced significantly a lot of the regulations in moving drugs forward, and there have been some reports of some drugs getting through that proved not to be too good.
I think absolutely the Obama administration had made improvements. I work in the state government affairs side, not so much on the science and regulatory affairs department that my colleagues who directly related and worked with, interfaced with FDA did. But certainly I think there can be more that needs to be done as patients are desperately waiting for cures and treatments. And we have some that are in line and there's just not enough FDA personnel to review and quickly enough. So we hope that there'll be even more done in the next few years in hopes for improvements for our patients.
But there is some legitimacy in terms of there's a reason why there's a rigorous protocol.
Yeah, absolutely.
Madam Chair, I'm not denying that, but I do know that bureaucracies over time become slugs, and that's what we have with the FDA when they're doing these reviews.
Chair Monica Anderson, Senator Beyer, I assure the committee and the public that this is a highly regulated industry when it comes to the Food and Drug Administration.
As it should be.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much. Very much. Now we will go to Dr. John Santa, John Bartholomew, and Jesse O'Brien. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Santa. I'm a primary care physician. I practiced in Oregon from 1976 to 1992 and 2003 to 2008. I won't go over my background in detail. We're old friends.
we've had
a chance to do work before. I'm here in part because of that work, because the common thread in that work was about transparency. Everything I worked on with you all was about transparency. And I'm here to tell you, it worked. It worked. Oregonians use and are so much more selective about health services than folks in the rest of the country. So much so that if you really want to be serious about dealing with the cost of health care, there ain't much room left there anymore for you. If you're in New York City, that's not the case. I mean, I lived in New York for 6 years. I came back to Oregon for all of my health care because my wife, who got health care there, it's incredible the overuse of health care tests and services and treatment in the state of New York. So we know how to do this here. And a big piece of that is transparency, and that's what these two bills are about. But as I mentioned, the cost of care is determined by the product of units used times price. And price is a problem in this state. We've seen this in studies before, and we've just seen it again in the Quality Corporation's study. There's enormous variation, and you know, in order to get what they need, industry in one way or another has been more successful at price increases here than elsewhere. What's nice about 792 especially is it's a simple idea. It's a simple idea. Provide some information about price to consumers and patients, and do that in a context, in information about the product, and information about both its benefits and risks. When I was at Consumer Reports, I mean, I testify as an individual, but for 6 years I lived in this intense environment of healthcare information and comparisons. Here's what I learned. Sellers would go to great extent. They should. That's part of their fiduciary duty to avoid providing price information. And there's just nobody that succeeded that better than healthcare organizations, including pharmaceutical companies. But, you know, it's a generic to the sellers on the healthcare side in general. Buyers are hungry for price information, so much so that we consistently found that our information and other information that did not include price was less credible, less attractive, less competitive. When we included price, our readership rates went up, our newsstand rates went up. Our audience wanted information about price, and they wanted it right there. Are there lots of sources about price? Sure. And some of those people would go to those sites. But the ability to see something in the same place really attracts readers. Now, Americans very well understand that they need to access multiple information sources to evaluate any purchase. You know, they don't make a decision based on Consumer Reports. They don't make it based on an advertisement. Actually, there's a nice piece in the New York Times a week or so ago about we collect information from all different sorts of sites. That's what knowledge is. Lots of sources. And Americans are smart buyers if they've got the information to become smart buyers. Now, sellers often argue that more information, you've just heard some of this, will confuse buyers. They don't mention the alternative. Keep them ignorant. All of us routinely choose to move from ignorance to confusion to knowledge. This is going to be confusing. That's the way markets work. The question really before you is, how dysfunctional do you want this market to continue to be? So during my career, I've heard over and over from healthcare policymakers that patients must be responsible, that patients need to have more skin in the game. I hate that phrase. You know, it's just so obnoxious to hear that you, the patient, need to have more skin in this game. Oregon patients have shown that they can be good buyers, but they need your help to be treated fairly. That starts with basic price information, easily provided. That's what Senate Bill 792 does. Thank you.
Chair Monis-Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the policy director for OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a statewide consumer advocacy group. And I'm very pleased to be here today in strong support of Senate Bills 792 and 793. We think these are two components of an urgently needed comprehensive approach to empowering patients and containing the rising cost of prescription drugs. The rising cost of prescription drugs is the number one healthcare consumer issue that we hear from our members about, and polls consistently show that this is a top concern for Americans across the political spectrum, across all demographic groups. Really, it's important to emphasize that these rising costs are a burden on all of us, not just those of us who depend on expensive specialty drugs for our quality of life or even to just keep ourselves alive at all, but it's a burden on all of us through rising health insurance insurance premiums, through rising costs for Oregon businesses that get passed along to all of the rest of us, and a growing burden on state and federal budgets. Both of these bills take some important steps to address the problem. I'm going to briefly talk about each of them in turn. On Senate Bill 792, we think this is a common-sense consumer protection measure that can help provide consumers with information about the cost of medications at the time when many consumers first hear about a drug, which is when they see or hear an advertisement. We think that the financial burden of paying for a drug can be so severe for some patients that providing price information up front provides a service that is just as needed as providing information about the medical side effects of a drug. So we think that the case for requiring this in advertisements is quite clear. I will mention just parenthetically that OSPIRG and our National Federation have long opposed the practice of direct-to-consumer drug advertising altogether. We think it encourages inappropriate prescribing, undermines the doctor-patient relationship, that it takes inappropriate advantage of information asymmetries that disadvantage consumers, and that it drives up drug costs, and that there's little reason to believe that the increased awareness of the availability of these drugs has a positive impact on patient health. There was a mention in prior testimony about DTC advertising increasing medication adherence. I would love to see evidence of that. I've not heard of that before. These marketing practices are also extraordinarily expensive. That issue has been covered already, so I won't go into the detail. While the state is not in a position to ban direct-to-consumer marketing altogether, we think the very least we can do is ensure that consumers are provided with all the information they need to make an informed decision about whether to ask their doctor about a drug, which definitely includes information about prices. I do think that there is a legitimate question about what price information should be included in advertisements, and this is a result of the fact that the way we pay for drugs is this incredibly convoluted Rube Goldberg machine that makes sense to basically no one, but I think that the most logical number is the number that the manufacturer actually has direct control over, because they are the ones who are advertising their drugs. But in any event, I'll move on to Senate Bill 793. We also think this is an urgently needed measure that will help treat the disease of skyrocketing prescription drug costs by requiring transparency and requiring rebates when prices exceed a reasonable rate as determined through an independent review similar to Oregon's existing health insurance rate review process. I believe everybody on the committee is already aware of the fact that OSPIRG for several years now has partnered with the Department of Consumer and Business Services to provide a voice for consumers in the health insurance rate review process, so we're very familiar with how that works. One of the things that we have seen in that process is that rising prescription drug prices are really a major and growing factor in rising health insurance premiums. I've included some information about that in here. I'd love to spend some time talking about where that came from. I doubt that anybody else would, so I'm going to just skip that over, and you can read about it in my written testimony. I will just point out that we observed that the average projected increase for prescription drug costs from 2016 to 2017 is approximately half the average increase for all other medical costs. We estimate that Oregon's rate review process has helped cut almost $200 million in waste and unjustified costs from health insurance premiums over the past several years, while requiring insurers to make public far more detailed information than this legislation would require. And in the face of this scrutiny, Oregon's health insurance market has remained highly competitive. This program really shows that accountability and transparency can work to bring down costs. We think this legislation is an important step toward applying those lessons to the market for prescription drugs. And I'll also just say, because I know this is one of the big points of contention about this legislation, that we do not believe that this would in any way be a windfall for the health insurance industry, and in fact we would oppose it strenuously if we thought that it was. There are a number of mechanisms that have already been described that will prevent that from happening, including the health insurance rate review process. I would also say that we would like to see, as part of a comprehensive approach to rising prescription drug costs, some measures that did directly address consumer out-of-pocket costs as well. But I am not at all concerned that this measure by itself will lead to windfall profits for the health insurance industry.
Let's go with John and then open it up for questions.
Thank you, Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. We have over 500,000 members in the state of Oregon. Probably some of those folks you talked to as you were doing doors and bringing this issue up, because this is one of the top issues for our members here in the state and nationally. Older Oregonians, older Americans are being faced with significantly higher prescription drug prices, whether it's out of pocket or seeing their insurance premiums rise as a result of the forces driven by the prescription drug prices on the insurance premium. We've put out some data. I've given you some written testimony. I just wanted to highlight a few items here. One is that high prices put an unfair burden on older Americans. In 2015, some data shows that the average annual cost for one brand name drug used on a chronic basis is now over $5,800. The average older American takes 4.5 prescription drugs per month. So if you add all that together, that's about $26,000 per year, but the median income for Medicare beneficiaries is $24,150. So, you know, that's averaging things together, but it shows how much of an impact this has on older Oregonians. So we like this legislation in particular because of the transparency. Transparency is one of the issues that we support at the state and federal level in terms of how to get at this as a long-term approach. It's a very complex issue. We also support things like allowing Medicare to be able to negotiate for lower drug prices with the pharmaceutical firms. But in the absence of any kind of federal action, we really do urge the legislature to take action now, because we're hitting kind of a crisis state. So we asked some of our members briefly, how is this impacting you? And some of the responses, we got a lot of responses really quickly on this. A lot of people are feeling this viscerally every single day. There are several key themes about this. One is that for our members, the costs are increasing, but their incomes are not. They're on fixed incomes. Two, many people will go without their medications or cut back as a result of the costs, which does no good for anyone, really. It doesn't matter if they have insurance or not, costs are going up either way. So their co-pays are going up, or their premiums are going up, or they're paying out of pocket, and that's going up. And many people end up choosing between medications and other needs like food, housing, and utilities. A couple real brief ones, just showing kind of the increase. Alan in Medford noted, I am a diabetic and have to spend more than $1,500 on medication each month. Last year it was $500 a month, and the year before $300 a month. Mark in Corvallis noted, I have to split my pills in half in order to afford them. Susan in Redmond, we have been given prescriptions that are over $350 a month, which I cannot afford and still be able to live. We are on Medicare and Social Security with a small pension and barely able to pay our bills. Mike in Gates, I have had to switch to cheaper, less effective alternatives and discontinue the use of some medications due to their expense, resulting in a decrease of overall health. And Kathy in Prineville notes that she is now ordering a drug from a Canadian pharmacy at a fraction of the cost she can get it from her U.S. pharmacy. And she bases her decisions on medications with my doctor, not necessarily on the best drug for my condition, but one that is affordable. So this is part of the solution in terms of dealing with the high cost of prescription drugs and the overall system. I really appreciate the focus on trying to find a way that gets at the root cause of the problem, which is the prices, and ultimately we will be able to put a patchwork together of different things at the federal and state level to make prescription drugs more affordable for everyone. Thank you for your time.
Questions? I had someone bring to me attention, this is for Jesse, about the article in the Lund Report and also an article in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed pharmaceutical companies influence different groups in our healthcare system. And I just wanted to know if Osberg received money from pharmaceutical companies or any organizations that would prevent you from providing impartial testimony.
Senator Monis-Anderson, thank you for that question. I am familiar with that New England Journal of Medicine article, which suggests that about 83% of the top patient advocacy groups receive significant funding from the pharmaceutical industry. I would not want to necessarily impugn the motives of any of those groups as a result of taking that funding. I think they do good work, but I do think it raises some questions about their impartiality with regard to these kinds of issues in particular. I don't know the answers to those questions, but I think it raises those questions. And for Osberg's part, I can say that we have made a commitment to our members for over 45 years now that we never take a dime of corporate money from anyone, specifically in order to avoid raising those questions for policymakers and for our members.
Thank you. All right, no further questions. Thank you very much. What I think I'm going to do, well, I know I'm going to do because it was at the suggestion of Senator Cruz. We have a number of prescription drug bills, Senate Bill 237, Senate Bill 270, 272, 792, 793, possibly 951. And so we'd like Senator Steiner Hayward and Senator Cruz to look at these bills, figure out, and maybe have Mr. Droppers be sort of the staff to coordinate these meetings and see what we can come up with. And I'd like them to take into account Representative Noce's bill that's hopefully going to be somewhere so we can pick it apart. Anyway, so I do want everyone to know that. And if you have input, please share that with Senator Cruz and Senator Steiner Hayward on these various bills that I mentioned. Okay, with that, I am going... Oh, wait, before I close, Brian DeLashmet, who used to be a lobbyist here, wanted me to read his testimony. And he said he's out of town today, but in July of 2014, he was diagnosed with a rare blood disease called multiple myeloma. And at the time, he was unaware that he was ill, and a trip to the hospital with a kidney stone revealed that he was very ill and was told that he only had days to live. His blood was more than 95% cancerous, and the calcium blood levels were double the normal rate, which was the highest blood calcium rate the doctors had ever seen. At the time, he was told both the bad and good news that the cancer could not be cured, only treated, but that only 15 to 20 years ago, no treatments would have been available to extend the life. Fortunately, the kidney stone saved his life, and he was admitted and treated and stabilized. And after 6 months of heavy doses of chemotherapy, OHSU did a stem cell transplant. And with that, he was given... 8 to 9 prescriptions. He's now down to 5 prescriptions, and 2 of those prescriptions, both forms of chemotherapy. Each day costs him, for a 28-day supply, $17,041, and that's $608 a day. What he's wanting to let us know that... he can afford his share of the costs of the drugs, but many of the people he sees on a regular basis can't. And some of the programs help with extreme costs. And I know that pharmaceuticals have told me about some of these programs, but some of these programs, whether by a drug company or by one of the many nonprofits, attempt to help these people. However, either the income ceiling to qualify is low or the nonprofits run short on money and cannot help those who can't afford even the hundreds of dollars each month. So, in short, he wants to support any legislation that helps those who can't afford the high cost of staying alive. And with that, he just wanted to share. Okay, thank you. I think that's it for Senate Bill 93 and 92. I'll close those public hearings and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 419, Representative Nose and Senator Beyer.
I should all stay and listen.
Do you want to go first? Huh? So do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll be very
first. Okay.
Is he against them?
Since we have nobody left.
Please proceed.
No. All righty. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator, Mr. Vice Chair. For the record, you really wore everybody out, I see. For the record, I am Lee Beyer, State Senator from District 6. And here to testify in support of Senate Bill 419, but I will say at the start that my intent would be not to move the bill as it's drafted, but rather I have an amendment being prepared that would create a task force or a work group to take a look at this in the interim. I think it's an interesting idea to take a look at. That's why I brought the bill. Actually, this is the second time that the good representative and I have brought this bill. Last time, I think you had some discussions on it, had heard from some folks from Maryland, I think, and as well as passed out a different one that was to provide more transparency on rates, to provide more information. That's gone forward, at least the first couple of cuts of that one. I found the information pretty useless, but it is what it is. Why do this? Why even consider this? When I was looking at it following Maryland, I noticed that they have the lowest hospital rates, thank you, that they have the lowest hospital rates consistently of all 50 states. They are below, the last information I've seen, which I think might be a couple of years old, was they were below the national Medicare rates as well. So there's something there. And one of the things that really interested me when I began this is where you look back to when they started this in 1971. They've been doing it a long time. Where the idea came from for the rate review was from the Maryland Hospital Association. They're the ones who proposed it. And when we talked to them in 2015 and since then, the Hospital Association, the equivalent of the Oregon of our Medical Association, the insurer providers in that community, and the regulators all liked their system very well. They thought it stabilized the system, they thought it kept rates low, and they thought it got at some of the things that we're trying to do on the Medicaid side in terms of doing global budgeting and holding costs down. So I guess what I would say is there's something there. I don't know whether it would work perfectly or well with the system we're going on cost containment. That seems to be the subject of the day. But I think it's well worth looking at when you've got, man, I think that's 40 years of operation in the state of Maryland, a pretty good proven track record of keeping costs down and hospital costs down, and all the people who participate in the system seem very happy with it. Again, I would just say there's something there worth looking at. I look at this process something similar to the rate setting. I think we heard Pat from DCBS talk earlier about they could do this. This rate setting and dealing with that is not a new concept in Oregon or anywhere. We certainly do it with utility rates, making sure that we keep companies healthy. I had 10 years of experience doing that. As that regulator, we do it in the insurance marketplace. We do it in a number of places, so it's not a new concept. The question is there value at the end of the day? And that's one that I think is worth exploring. So with that, I will stop and let the good representative.
Thank you, Senator Monis Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz. For the record, my name is Rob Noss. I'm the state representative for House District 42, which consists of inner southeast Portland and a little sliver of northeast Portland. They don't like to be forgotten. I'm hoping some of the pharmaceutical lobbyists stayed behind to listen to this, because they've been accusing me of only focusing on one cost driver in the healthcare system, and to the detriment of only focusing on theirs, and that's absolutely not true based on my support of this bill, which we have a very similar concept in our chamber. And, you know, sort of in preparation for coming over here and for the bill that I did, I tried to find out what it costs to have something done at the hospital, and I picked having a baby, a normal vaginal delivery, and then I also considered a C-section. I spent 5 minutes trying to find a price, and I gave up. First, you can't find anything easily on the web for the cost of these procedures in hospitals in Oregon. The estimates you can find sometimes come from national websites and articles that are outdated and show a range of prices as opposed to the actual price. And I won't go on with the descriptions, but you know, you couldn't really find anything. Finally, I Googled what it costs at a few large hospitals in the Portland metro area. I plugged in the specific name of the hospital, and it named several different hospitals, but I had no luck with that either. It was easier to find out what tuition was at OHSU for a med student than it is to figure out what I would pay to have a baby at a hospital. And I'm told there's a hospital website that does it for us, but that never even came up in my Google search. I know we all know that no one pays the list price. If you have insurance, you pay a copay or a percentage of the cost, and your insurance plan pays the rest. Though with current plan designs and HSAs becoming more popular, knowing what is charged and then what your exposure is going to be might be useful. At the same time, we know that different health insurance plans have worked out different rates with different hospitals. If your plan is a good deal and has a network of preferred hospitals, you might pay one thing if you go to that hospital. And if your plan does not have a network, or you have an emergency delivery and you have to be seen at an out-of-network hospital, you will pay something else. And of course, we know that Oregon Health Plan patients don't pay anything. I think you get my point. This is hardly a market. And lack of competition, particularly in communities where there's only one hospital, you know, it just makes it even harder in terms of they can charge whatever they want or whatever they work out, kind of like the drug market. We also know that many hospitals have recovered from the Great Recession, and since the full implementation of the Affordable Care Act, they have done well financially. The state of Oregon tracks this for us. The Oregon Health Authority puts together a very, I think, awesome spreadsheet that I submitted for the record, and should be on OLIS, that shows the profit and loss and charity care trends for hospitals in Oregon. Now, some hospitals are clearly struggling. Coquille Hospital in Coquille, Oregon, they had a 17.4% loss in 2015. I think that's pretty devastating. At the same time, our state's two only for-profit hospitals, McKenzie Willamette and Springfield in Willamette Valley and McMinnville, each had a 33% margin of profit after charity care expenses. And while a loss of 18% is not a good thing for a rural hospital, I think we should be very concerned that a profit of 33% on health care should also have us worried. So Senate Bill 419 is a bill that's similar to my own, House Bill 2679. It's a simple bill that, if implemented, would usher in a very big change in the way that we deal with hospital finance in this state. I suspect it's not that simple to implement. I'll just say I probably support the task force idea as well. The simple explanation of the bill is that it basically sets up a commission that would establish what hospitals would charge patients. Perhaps there would be one price for a normal vaginal delivery in the Portland area and another in Bend. Perhaps it would take into account the need for a basic infrastructure like a hospital place in an area, you know, where there isn't a large patient volume versus one where there's a lot, you know, and so the charges would need to be different so that the basic infrastructure of that institution could be sustained. But ideally, it would help set a charge for a procedure that would make sense and allow for some cost comparison and understanding by patients and consumers about what things cost and why. I know, I think Maryland is the only state that continues to do this. I submitted a report for OLIS. It's a long report, but it's very interesting and does a really good job, I think, of highlighting all the issues that there are. And I thank the Hospital Association for providing that to me. How it was implemented in Maryland, why other states abandoned it, and what's working. If we were really going to implement this and not just look at a task force to try to do it, it probably would have a pretty big fiscal, and we'd probably need to make that board or commission, I would argue, full-time, because they'd be setting up rates and charges for 60-some hospitals in the state of Oregon. And that's, you know, my understanding is the PUC was full-time for, what, four investor-owned utilities?
No, more than that.
There's more than that. Okay. I don't know enough about the PUC, obviously. I'll defer to you. But I mean, this would be a big undertaking, and it would be, I think, hard for a volunteer board just to do it all on its own. And it would need, you know, according to folks from Maryland, it would need to have a pretty robust staff to be able to do the analysis and work that would be needed so that we could figure out what to charge, but also make sure that we're standing up hospitals in a good way, that they're going to be financially viable and successful.
Okay. We only have a few minutes, and we have six more people to testify.
Okay. It's a good idea. We should do it, but we probably need to study it, actually, to be able to implement it.
Great. Oliver, will you phone in? We are going to have a former Maryland rate review commissioner, give some testimony. And
Hello, this is Robert Murray.
Hi, Robert Murray. This is Senator Lori Montes Anderson. Welcome to the Health Committee. We would love to have your input on how the system of a hospital rate commission works in Maryland. We really need you to keep your comments very brief, since we're running towards the end of our session. But welcome, and please proceed.
Sure. Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name, again, is Robert Murray. Just very quickly, by way of background, I'm a consultant, management consulting, residing in Maryland. And my expertise has been in designing payment systems for providers. Prior to being a consultant, my most significant professional experience was I was executive director of the Maryland Hospital Rate Setting System for 17 years, from 1994 to 2011. I've published a number of articles and reports on rate setting. I think you may have a couple of those articles in front of you. So I'll just try to make a few brief comments and then open it up for questions. I think overall I'm an advocate for regulatory approaches for cost containment, but they're also not the only approach to cost containment. And often the best strategy is to combine rate setting or regulation with other more market-based approaches. But rate setting is a very daunting undertaking. And I mentioned at the previous hearing last week that the Health Secretary, Josh Sharfstein in Maryland, used to describe the system the way Homer Simpson described alcohol, that rate setting in Maryland was both the cause of and the solution to all life's problems. And that just means that it has its pros and cons, and that the pros and cons fluctuate over time. The other thing to mention is that because rate setting is so complicated and can get very technically involved and detailed and subject to other failures and breakdowns, of the key seven mandatory states, only Maryland and also West Virginia are the only two states to keep rate setting. So a number of states have tried it, a number of states decided it wasn't for them and failed for a variety of reasons. I'll make a couple of points about what's important to include in rate setting. One is to have the system be multi-payer or all-payer. The most successful rate setting systems are those that include federal payers like Medicare and Medicaid to create uniform incentives and a more balanced system. And so that requires a waiver from Medicare, the payments nationally. And of course, the situation nationally is quite uncertain, just given the change in administration. And I should mention, too, these waivers, while they have been granted in the past, they are fully at the discretion of the federal government as to whether they continue. And I kind of said flippantly at the other hearing a couple of weeks ago that you could basically have a waiver approved potentially and then find out in a tweet from the president that it was terminated. It could happen that quickly. There'd be a phase out, of course, but it is somewhat of an unpredictable circumstance now. I wanted to also mention that rate setting up these systems is very complicated. It's a significant resource undertaking to establish rates that are fair and effective reimbursement systems for healthcare services. And although there's some similarities between hospital rate setting and public utility rate setting, as you can imagine, setting prices for hospital services, healthcare services generally, it's not like setting a price for electricity or gas. Those are homogeneous products. And rate setting for healthcare, you've got just for inpatient. Medicare has over 750 different diagnoses that they set rates for inpatient, and over 1,000 different categories and payment groups for outpatients. So it can get very complicated. The resource requirements, too, are quite significant. My old agency now has 35 professional staff. These are highly trained people, generally, and a budget of about $13 million. And the rate setters there still think they're underfunded. So it requires multiple systems, data systems, reporting systems, audit compliance. There's the negotiations that take place and go on. There's a research and methodology staff that basically requires PhD health economists and also legal staff. I should mention we were challenged. We've been challenged a number of times legally. Fortunately, we won most of those cases, but that's also another risk that undermined a system, and it did actually, in the case of New Jersey, contribute to the demise of that system. Just a couple closing points. I should make a point about the waiver in Maryland. You probably heard that there's a lot of support for the system in Maryland. That's true, but it's in large part, particularly from the hospital's perspective, because the waiver in Maryland was established at a time when Medicare was paying about 30% higher Medicare rates in Maryland than the rest of the country. And while we were able to reduce the rate of growth for Medicare over time, the payment levels in Maryland for Medicare are still 20 to 25% above the U.S. Medicare payment levels. They're not below. And this results in close to $2 billion extra payment to Maryland hospitals from the federal government.
Oh,
and
that's
quite simply why they support it, in addition
of
to
course.
Some of the fairness and equity aspects of the system. I would also make mention of the fact that now, with hospital services diminishing as a percentage of total cost and expenditures in healthcare, Maryland is trying to expand their system to make it more of a total cost of care system and also a population-based system and move away from the fee-for-service incentives that have been baked into most payment structures in the U.S. My understanding is that this bill would not create a population-based payment system. It would preserve fee-for-service. My understanding, too, is this bill would not have provisions in to promote quality of care explicitly. That's another big feature of the Maryland system. They're trying to move more towards promoting value, meaning improved efficiency and also improved quality. So overall, I would say never, but there are times to look at doing this, and there are also structures and characteristics that give you a higher probability of success. I should say we have great law, and it helps out our success. But Washington State adopted our law word for word and then failed in implementation. So it's not that's not the only key ingredient. You have to have most all of the people in the state and then craft a system that's holistic. Let me stop there and see if you have any
great
questions.
Well, we do not have time for questions. We need to be out of here unless you have a quick one. Yeah. But what it looks like we're going to do a study rather than do any kind of implementation on this bill. And so we probably will be getting back in touch with you over the interim. So thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Murray.
Yeah, absolutely. Very happy to help, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, and now we will call up John Larson. Jared, are you going to be? Okay.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Larson. I have been a teacher in Oregon for 25 years in Morrow County and in Hermiston. I am currently on a leave of absence from the Hermiston School District as to act as the vice president for the Oregon Education Association, and I serve on the OEB board as well. I want to talk a little bit about my experience as bargaining chair in both Morrow County and Hermiston Association of Teachers. Over the years, when we bargain, we tend to bargain salary and benefits for our members. Over the past 10 years, the resources have been extremely strained in our schools, as you know, and the expectation for the coming year is further exacerbated. And the gains, if any, have been modest in both benefits and salary. Yet the insurance rates have continued to rise at a very large level. And so on Tuesday at the OEB meeting, they announced that of the five plans, which generally we have an even distribution of all of our members in each of those five plans, this plan year, we had more than half of OEB members migrate to the bottom two plans, which are the lowest premium but the highest cost-sharing plans that exist in OEB. I know that when I was teaching in Morrow County and in Hermiston, though we don't represent the classified staff there, I knew classified employees who actually wrote a check to the district at the end of the month, and they were working strictly for their medical benefits. And so when many of the OEB board members were surprised that people had migrated to those plans, that was not a surprise to me at all. The solution then became, well, how do we deal with that? And so they talked about raising the rates on those two plans at a higher percentage than on the larger plans to help account for the great number of people that are going into those plans. Well, that's problematic for me, and I think that over the years, what we hear from people is you've got to bend the cost curve, and you've got to be able to do things like not seeking care at the emergency room and finding ways to be more well. And I think we've really embraced that and really taken that into account. What we haven't done is address the other side of that cost curve, and that is the hospital rates and the pharmaceutical rates that continue to go up at a very fast clip. And so while I feel like the employees and the workers and the citizens of Oregon are doing their share, paying their share of these increased costs, the pharmaceutical companies and the hospitals are not, and so I would urge support of Senate Bill 419.
Thank you very much. All right. Thank you. Okay, well, we have we will carry a Senate Bill 419 over to Tuesday, March 14th, and it'll be first on the agenda. And I think we have four more people to testify on this bill. Okay, and maybe we'll even have an amendment ready by then, or do you think? The other thing, although there's not many left in the audience, I do want to say this at the beginning. April 7th, that's only eight meetings from now. I believe it's eight meetings from now. We have to post for all our bills that we're going to work session. So we still have a number of bills that we need to hear, and I just want people to not, if you want your bill heard, let Mr. Droppers and me know, because we're running out of time. All right, well, we will carry over the work session for House Bill 2267. And have I done everything? We're adjourned.